Okay, welcome to this fourth morning talk, if I've got it right, of this 2007 Easter retreat. I've already talked about what meditation is and just the obstacles and using mindfulness to overcome those obstacles. I wanted to focus again on some of the aspects of meditation. Remember, the overview is to find a means of calming the mind, because by calming the mind, not only does the mind become energized with brightness and happiness, but it also is able to see clearly. And it gives you the reward of the meditation retreat. You feel good, you're happy, you see things deeply, and you realize that that's a sign the meditation is working. And I did use a simile twice already about the going up the hillside. When you go in a car, when you walk, when you slow down and stop, it's a completely different experience. Exactly the same what happens in meditation. The more you slow down, the more different you experience the life around you. Whether it's the breakfast, whether it's the grass, whether it's the sunshine or the sound of the birds, the slower you go, the more fully you feel them. Which is why that the old argument, which still goes on, is there any difference between this calming meditation and insight meditation? What in Pali was Samatha and Vipassana, that is really a debate which should have been settled a long time ago, because there is no difference. Anyone who practices this method of meditation will realize that the more you calm the mind, the more deeply you see, and the more deeply you see, the more calm you get. The two always will go together. And I have been using the simile also for those people who want a nice, easy way to answer any of your friends, what you did here, was it Samatha, was it Vipassana? You usually use the story of Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana, who were great friends. One day decided to go for a walk together. It was a nice Easter Monday, no work to do. So they decided to go a walk up the hill. And Mr. Samatha wanted to go up the hill because it was so peaceful on top of the mountain. And Mrs. Vipassana wanted to go up the mountain because they had this gorgeous view on top of the mountain. So they went up the mountain for different goals. Mr. Samatha went up there for the peace. Mrs. Vipassana went up there for the view. But when Mr. Vipassana sort of got up to the top of the mountain, sure, he appreciated the peace and the calm on top of the summit. But he also had eyes, so he could also enjoy the beautiful, gorgeous view from up there. And Mrs. Vipassana, when she got to the top, she also enjoyed a wonderful view. And she also experienced a deep sense of peace. Because on the top of the mountain, there is not just peace, there's also the view. There's not just the view, there's also the peace. Because the two coexist on top of the mountain. That's a very accurate simile to describe what meditation is. Because the more peaceful you get, the more you'll see, the higher up the mountain you go, the better the view and the calmer it is. And you know that the more you see, the more peaceful it must be. So the two will always go together. So you know exactly what you're doing in this meditation. Sometimes that when, you know, being a teacher, people want to find out what their progress is, and they ask, how's the progress going? And sometimes that people come and tell you their most profound of insights. It doesn't mean anything to me. Because you can read those things in books. And people can make up insights. Sometimes in these Zen retreats, that's what you're supposed to do. You're outside the Zen master's room. And you've got to make some great insight to tell the master. And sometimes it can sound profound, but doesn't really make any sense. That's why sometimes you try and out-Zen the Zennies. That's why there was once a very, very famous story about the two monks arguing because there was a flag blowing in the wind. And one monk said, oh, can you see that flag blowing in the wind? And the other monk said, the flag is not blowing, the wind is moving. And the other said, no, not the wind moving, the flag is moving. And so they went to the Zen master, who said, you're both wrong, the mind is moving. And that didn't satisfy them, so they went to the Theravada forest Ajahn, who said, all three of you wrong. It's not that the flag is moving. It's not that the wind is moving. It's not the mind is moving. Your mouths were moving. So shut up. Whatever it is. I try to sort of, you know, go one better. It's all just keeping up with the Joneses sort of thing. But anyway, I don't mind having a bit of fun and games there. So anyway, the most profound of sayings doesn't really, you know, mean very much. So you usually can test how deep your meditation is going, not by the wise and profound things you can say, but by how peaceful you are. You can fake insights, but you can't fake peace. It's very clear how calm you are. That's why I always take like calm and peace as a benchmark to see how you're progressing in meditation. Not the insights which you can flash up to you in the meaning of life and reconciling all the great religions. Those sorts of insights are nowhere near as meaningful as the peace which is generated. So that's how you know how your meditation is going. And to, once you understand that that's how you know the meditation is going, that is the path to enlightenment. That brings along the insights on the way. It calms all the difficulties. It settles the problems, which is why it's called calming. Settling the problems of existence. And so when you understand that peace is the path and the goal, then you know what you're supposed to be doing in this meditation. And as I've been stressing again and again and again, the way to find that peace is not to strive for it, because it's a striving which agitates and creates the opposite of peace. Every time you strive and struggle, you tend to disturb the whole process. What Ajahn Chah used to say, I remember him using his hand as his visual aid. He would wave it up and down. He said, "These are like the leaves on the trees. They move up and down, but that's not their natural state." He said they move up and down because the wind is blowing on them. And if you can just remove the wind, the leaves would move less and less and less until they come to perfect stillness, which is the nature of the leaf on the tree. And we get the message. He said that's the same with your mind. The only reason it's not at peace is because there's something blowing on it. There's a wind of craving which makes it vibrate. If we can only just take away that wind of craving, your mind will move less and less and less. It won't stop abruptly. It will move less and less. It will calm down slowly and slowly and slowly until, who knows, it might come to a complete stop. And that is what we're doing in this meditation. The nature of the mind is to be still, but it moves because of craving. And that craving is a doing, and it's a controlling, it's a making things happen. Everybody on a retreat such as this, as a teacher, as the people managing this retreat, we try our best to remove all possible sources of craving for you. All your escape routes into craving your food. You can't ring up for your favourite pizza, because the gates are locked at night, so the pizza boy can't come in. You can't choose very much what you're eating, it's just a very simple choice. And you can't choose what music or TV, what video you're going to watch. So many of your abilities to crave and to excite the mind are taken off. And you're sitting here, just on your cushion, on your chair, so hour after hour after hour all day with nothing to do. It may sound boring at first, especially to people who have no experience of meditation. Because you're removing the craving, that leaf is moving less and less and less. And everyone on a retreat, they calm down a lot by the end of the 9 days. You have to, because whole momentum is actually moving in that direction, a momentum of letting go. But we also use these talks and these interviews and the questions and answers to encourage you, just to knowing how that letting go works. And remember, you don't do letting go. Letting go is what happens when you stop doing anything at all. It's a natural thing. So be very careful when you see this word letting go. Don't do the letting go. Let go of doing. There's a huge difference there between doing, letting go, and letting go of doing. However, it is still so complicated for people that on retreats I try and talk about the four ways of letting go. And those four ways of letting go are actually spoken by the Buddha very clearly in probably the most famous discourse he ever gave, the first discourse, the Dhammacakka Sutta, when he described the Four Noble Truths. Unfortunately, that many people, they skim over some of these teachings and they don't linger long enough to really investigate them fully. One of the great things of reading sutras or sayings of the Buddha is that you can read them once, 20 times. And especially after you've meditated, you can see things in there, wow, you never noticed before. It's brilliant, beautiful teachings. But this particular teaching is in the Third Noble Truth. Because all you know, you may know the Second Noble Truth is that craving causes suffering. And the Third Noble Truth is letting go of that craving is a path of Nibbana. That's why sometimes there's a trick question, because it's nice when you're giving a talk to try and engage the people in the audience. Sometimes actually to get some response out of them, I sometimes ask them, the Buddha taught two types of meditation, what two types are they? And everyone says Samatha Vipassana. They know that's not the right answer. The two types of meditation which people do in today's world are Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Second Noble Truth Meditation is desire, 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 desire. I want, I want, I want. I want to be peaceful. I want to sort of get rid of my cancer. I want to sort of get insights. I want to get psychic powers so I can read other people's thoughts and find out what my husband is really thinking. I want to get sort of so one and be a stream winner in this life. I just want to get some peace so I don't feel so stressed out. That's called Second Noble Truth Meditation. You've got a desire there, something you want from the meditation. It's craving. And I mention this because everybody here should know the Second Noble Truth says desire leads to peace, to enlightenment. What does it lead to? Suffering, yeah. So if you had any suffering in your meditation retreat so far, don't blame yourself. Don't blame me. Don't blame Bianca. Don't blame the retreat center. Blame desire, craving. That's what caused it. That's what the Buddha said. If craving causes suffering, then suffering must be caused by craving. You've wanted something. That's why you got frustrated. That's why you suffered. That's why you got bored. That's why you're going up the wall. That's why you want to leave. That's why it's nothing to do with the place. It's to do with craving, wanting. And the Buddha taught in his Third Noble Truth four ways of letting go of that craving, of stopping it, of getting peace, of letting go, of being still. And that's what leads to enlightenment. It also leads to the jhanas on the way. And those four ways, I mentioned one last night, but I didn't mention it in full because I was saving it for this morning. The four ways of letting go are chaga, which means generosity, giving. Patinisaga means throwing away, discarding things. Muti means freedom. And the last one, analia, means having what I call the Teflon mind, where nothing sticks at all. And this morning I'm going to go through those four. Mentioned in brief yesterday what chaga means. It's giving, it's generosity. But sometimes it's rare to find pure generosity in this world. Very often people only give their material or their time if there's something in it for them. If they're going to get, as I said yesterday, tax relief, when it gets to the end of the year, many people or companies are looking for, you know, ways of reducing their taxes, and they sort of feel good at the same time because they're giving it to some sort of charity. But, you know, it's not real giving, it's, you know, what's in it for me. Or sometimes people do that for their fame, because they get something, respect because of how generous they are. And those are the people who like their names be put on the board somewhere. I'm not sure if you've seen that little sign just where the question box is. I think it says, in memory of, I think, Father Frank Cahill, for, what's it saying in, remember? Yeah, I'd say, for, I think for someone like alcoholic priest or something. No, that's not what it actually says on there. It looks almost like that he was the most famous alcoholic, which is why, if you can read it that way on the plaque, every time I go, have a look at it when you go past it, and you can read it the other way. It's, you know, for alcoholic, not actually for, it doesn't say for preventing alcoholism. Obviously that's what it's for, but you can read it the other way. But anyway, that people have like their names on plaques. Now, whenever they do something or give something, to get some sort of recognition. And of course, that really isn't anything to do with giving. And as I say, it's business. And I know in many temples, you know, that people give donations and they want the room named after them or the hall named after them, a whole list of the donors, you know, in order. And they sometimes even have the amount which each person gives. It's just advertising themselves, that's all. It's not real generosity. Or even that sometimes really people help and they give, you know, to some sort of cause. They serve in the background. They sweep or they wash up afterwards. And sometimes that when someone comes and thanks everybody, they leave out their names and they feel that they're not appreciated. It's a sign that your giving was actually wanting something back, at least wanting appreciation or wanting thanks. Again, that's not real giving. Real giving is just, that's selfless, just giving, expecting nothing back in return. Just for the sake of giving. Just because it needs to be done. And once that act of giving is complete, you don't want anything back. My teacher Ajahn Chah once sort of explained, if anyone ever gives anything to you, you are, as it were, in debt to them. You know, there is something you have to do afterwards. But he said, what you should do afterwards is not give them a gift back in return. If anyone has given something to you, then you have to give a gift to somebody else. And tell them, don't say thank you or give me a gift back. You go and give it to somebody else. And that way the gift goes on and on and on and never ends. And he said, if I give you the gift of Dhamma, the highest gift, and teach you how to meditate, how to be peaceful, how to be free, don't thank me back. What you have to do, if I've given you that peace and that freedom, is you find someone else and give that peace and freedom to them. And tell them once they have that peace and freedom, not to give it back, but to give it on to someone else. And that way that peace and freedom is always given to somebody else, and never returned. When it's returned, it goes backwards. When it keeps given on and on, it keeps spreading. Spreading the beauty and the calm through everybody. So the gift, you should never give it back again. And Ajahn Chah told me that, and so now I am repaying his gift by giving it to you. And when you feel you have some peace and happiness, don't come and thank me. You give it to somebody else. That's the way giving works. But you give, you don't expect, you don't want anything back in return. A giving is a way of letting go. Now how that works with our meditation is that sometimes that when we give our time, you know, these 9 days to meditation, how many of you want something back in return? You come to this meditation retreat saying, well, I've got 9 days, these are my goals, I want to be peaceful, you know, I want to get rid of my problems. If you've been here many, many times, you know, this time I'm going to get at least nimittas. This is my goal, I'm going to meditate to get nimittas or even jhanas. If you come into a retreat and you are wanting something back in return, you always will have those expectations. The cravings will be there. And because the cravings are there and the expectations, there will be suffering. You're making the suffering for yourself with those expectations and goals. And the Buddhist way is far more refined. You say, I've come to this retreat not to get something, but to give. To give my whole body and mind to every moment, expecting nothing back in return. When I was in Indonesia, one of the monks doing a question and answer session in a big talk in Bali. Somebody asked the question, why is it that all these people go to the Buddhist temples and they come out angry, even more angry than they were when they came in? Why isn't Buddhism working for them? And it's a very tough question. But the monk who answered it, he said, I want to answer that. And he said, it's because in Bali, in sort of traditional sort of Chinese, we might call it Buddhism, people go to the temple to try and get something. They never go there to give things. Even when they give a donation, it's a donation so that, that girl will actually go out with me, or I'll get the promotion, or that, my cancer will disappear, or that, my mother will recover from her sickness. How many people actually go to temples, Buddhist temples in many places, not to give and let go, but actually to get something? Even when they sort of make a donation, they make a resolution. By the power of this merit, may I win the lottery. May the horses, sort of, which I back, please come through. Whatever it is, that sometimes, that not sometimes, most times, we're actually not really giving. We're just doing business. So in actually the meditation, see if you can develop that purest of all givings, to give your whole body and mind to this moment. Give it to the breath, and you don't want anything back in return. You're giving, not getting. With that type of pure intention of giving yourself fully to this moment, not asking for anything, not expecting anything, not demanding it works, my goodness, you get so peaceful very quickly. You really do get into the deep meditations, because your craving, the desire, the agitation, the thing which moves the leaf, is being taken away. You get just incredibly still. I don't want anything. I mentioned in the first night, or first day, about the no desire. It's easy to say no desire, no desire, no desire, no desire, and sometimes the mind might get it after half an hour of saying no desire, no desire, no desire. But sometimes we need to be a bit more informed of what we mean by no desire. And giving, expecting nothing back in return, is one of those ways. So be careful when you're meditating. If you expect anything, if you want anything, if you demand anything from the meditation, you're not giving. Your meditation is just a business transaction again. I'm doing this to get something afterwards. It's craving, it will lead to suffering. And if you want to end that suffering, just give, no expectations, no anticipations. I don't want anything for myself. I'm just giving this as an act of dana. Which is why, of all the acts of dana, all the great acts of good karma, say the gift of the Dhamma is one of the highest gifts. But the higher gift than that is giving your body and mind to the moment in meditation. It is the release of the mind, is the highest form of karma. That's what the Buddha said. Higher than all sort of material gifts is keeping the five... It's that going for refuge in the triple gem. Higher than that is keeping the five precepts. And higher than that is the release of the mind through meditation. And the Buddha stopped there. Nothing higher in terms of karma. Because you're releasing, you're giving, not expecting back. So every time in the meditation, that when there's a blockage there, when you're not getting anywhere and you're sort of getting a bit bored or tired or frustrated, remember giving. Giving everything, 100%, your whole body and mind, your whole life to this moment. And don't expect anything back. Give completely. And in that letting go, there'll be an enormous sense of peace, stillness and bliss. You go deep very quickly. Because you've understood the path of letting go. I call that sometimes pressing the letting go button. And it is like a button. If you just find it and you press it correctly, your meditation zooms into stillness very, very fast. It's amazing to watch. Sometimes you're meditating there for half an hour, and you're sort of getting peaceful but not really getting into it. And then you click that sort of that change of attitude. The letting go button, and wow, you start really blissing out and having a wonderful time. The whole thing starts to happen. and you get into some really nice meditations, which really just make the whole retreat worthwhile. So just remember, from time to time, give your whole body and mind to this moment. No matter what it is, don't demand it to be peaceful, to be blissful, just give, expecting nothing back. No anticipations, no wanting. And then the whole path works. The second way of letting go is called patinissago. It means like throwing things away, which again gets the idea you're not supposed to be getting things, you're supposed to be abandoning things. Just seeing how much you can dissemble yourself and just take yourself apart. So there's nothing left at all. All of your possessions, I'm not talking about your physical possessions, your mental possessions, your memories, your fears, just see whatever comes up. Yeah, don't want it, throw it out. You know, like you're doing a spring cleaning in the house and you've got all this junk which you've kept for such a long time. And there's so much junk, you keep it just in case. But you look at it, come on. You're never going to use that. You haven't used that in the last 10 years. You're not going to use it now. Chuck it out. Throw it out. Throw it away. I've got this simile of my mother's mantel shelf. I'm going to go and see her next week. So I'm sure I'll see this mantel shelf again. And I know what it's going to be like. Because the first few times I went to go and see her, you know, from Australia, you know, people actually, what can we, do you want to get a gift for your mother? So they gave me like one of these stuffed cute kangaroos. So that's the first time I gave her a kangaroo, you know, this little toy kangaroos. Next time, she already had one of those, so what's a koala, get her a koala, got a koala. And the next one, the third time I went to see her was a little kookaburra. And gee, you know, you got the koala, you got the kookaburra, it was a wombat. There's a big wombat. And I remember when I brought the wombat, you know, it was a big thing they gave me, not a small one, a big thing. When I brought it to her, you know, she had this, you know, above what was supposed to be like a fireplace, but you know, it was just like a gas fire to keep her apartment warm. It was like a shelf. And on top of that shelf, she kept all the knick-knacks. You know, all those things which people gave her and souvenirs from trips and stuff. And had all this stuff. And now, it was about, maybe about 15 years ago when I brought that first kangaroo, but that was still on there. Because that was important. That came from her son over in Australia. And the kookaburra was still there, and so was the koala. So, here, Mum, it's a wombat. And my poor mother tried to put it on the shelf. But there's so much other junk on there, she couldn't fit it in. And as she tried to squeeze it in, other stuff kept falling off. And so I told my mother, look, you've got that kangaroo there. You've had that for about 15 years. Throw that one away. Oh, no, I can't. It's important to me. And that's like the simile of my mother's mantel shelf. And you've got those, you've got all these possessions. Oh, it's so important to me. And you've got so much junk in there, you can't fit anything more in. And sometimes so that becomes almost mental breakdowns. You've got so much stuff in there that one more thing, and things start sort of crashing. If you just could empty out, have an empty shelf. And then when anyone comes and brings you something new, oh thank you, you can put it on there. And when someone else brings you the next thing, you can chuck that out and put the next thing on there. So you always have a place to receive things, because you are empty. Now that idea of like an empty mind, which is always open, can always receive things easily and freely, is what we mean by patinissaga. Throw out all the old stuff. All the old jhanas and enlightened experiences you have. Ah, that's old stuff, throw it away. That's the good memories, let alone the bad memories. All the stuff which happened yesterday. Gee, that's a long time ago. You know, there's these insects and these bugs, you know, they're born and they live for a couple of minutes. There's been generations have gone past since yesterday in the natural world, and you're still thinking about this ancient history called yesterday, let alone this morning. So chuck it all out. And that's what we mean, just why do I keep all this stuff? Chuck it out so you can be free and empty, so your mantel shelf, your shelf is just so free, and a new experience can come on, and it can actually go on there, and you can see it, and it's nice and simple, it doesn't keep falling off, it's stable. So you just throw as much as you possibly can of the past. And any time you see something coming up, chuck it out. Something more, chuck it out. And get this attitude of being always someone who chucks things away in your mind. You don't keep anything, especially not the sentimental things. You know, the nice, you know, fluffy, cute dolls of the past. They're the first you should go. And throw them all away. And then all the future, they haven't come yet, I'll leave them till later. And throw everything else you possibly can out. And throw all of your thoughts and ideas out. All your ideas of how to meditate and what meditation is supposed to be. Because a lot of those, they just clutter up the mind again. Sometimes people think, oh, I've got all these instructions, I must remember, you know, to sort of, no expectations, you know, to watch the breath, not too hard, be gentle, be peaceful. And you have all this list of instructions I've given you over the last 3 days. Chuck them all away. Throw everything out. So you're completely still and peaceful. There's nothing left in there. You've got this beautiful empty mind. An empty mind is like the empty sky. A cloud comes up over it and you can just see it so clearly. The sun is up and it warms you. And at night time you can see the moon and the stars so clearly. But only in this empty sky. That's why you do need the empty sky to see things clearly. A mind which isn't accumulating things. Which doesn't accumulate, that's not the point. The point of the meditation is not to get more things, but to see how much you can throw away. So whatever comes up, you throw it away. Even the nice stuff comes up, you tend to throw it away. So when you throw it away, you go closer and closer to emptiness. You don't accumulate. It's called letting go. And a simile which I've used is like these hot air balloons. Because I've never been in a hot air balloon myself, but I've seen people and read about it. And you have all these sandbags in the bottom and, you know, you sort of let go of the rope and you go floating up and it's so peaceful up there. And the reason apparently it's so peaceful is whatever way the wind blows, because it's got this huge surface area, the balloon goes 100% with the wind. So that way, when you're in the basket, because you're going completely with the wind, you never feel it. It's always silent and calm there. So you go up in this balloon, it's so peaceful and calm, you get this beautiful view as well, but you want to go higher and deeper. So how can you go higher? You have to look what other, they call it ballast, this weight you have in the basket. And you throw it out. And every time you throw something out of the basket, you always go higher. And you throw everything you possibly can out of that basket. And then there's nothing left in there. You've thrown your sandwiches, you've thrown your sort of thermos, you've thrown everything out. And you're really, really high now. And you think, what else can I throw out? And then the insight comes to you. The basket! I'll untie the basket and just hang on to the ropes. And so you throw the basket out. And then you're hanging on to the ropes. And you get really high. Now, in this simile, all the ordinary attachments you've thrown away. The last thing you discard to get into the deep, well, not to get into the first stage of deep meditation, is your body and its five senses. That's why we call the body a basket case. Some people more than others. You're letting go of something that's so important to you. And you go really high when you let go of this body. This body aches and pains and stiffness and stuff. Oh, forget about it. So you're sitting there and you've got to think, oh, I'm not interested in you. You just completely ignore it. And you can do that. It's not that hard to let go of feelings in the body when you really want to. And the simile which I give, fortunately they're not here on this retreat, but there is a Malaysian couple who live in Perth. And they told me one Friday night that a couple of nights before, during the week, they had been sitting watching the TV, watching a nice movie in their lounge room. And once the movie had finished, they got up, one went to go to the toilet, the other one went to make a cup of tea or something. Only when they got up, they started noticing there were many things missing from their room and from the rest of the house as well. A burglar had been into their house while they were watching the TV and were so cheeky they stole things from right behind the sofa where they were watching the movie. They were so engrossed in the movie. They didn't hear the burglar about a foot right behind them. Now think, oh, if only you could do that when you were meditating. Now, how many of you, when you're meditating, can actually sort of not hear the person behind you when they cough or when the beeper goes off? It was over that side this morning. whatever it is, can you actually focus so much like you're watching a movie, you can't hear anything, not even a burglar behind you? Now, that's actually when you know that you've started to let go of things. You let go of all those sounds because you're not concerned with them. They're not important to you. You throw them away. And that's like throwing away the basket. This body. So you don't know how many times you scratch it and it still itches. How many times you feed it and it's still hungry. How many times you take it to the toilet and it still wants to go again. So demanding, this body. And those of you who've got sicknesses, you've looked after this body so much and you've done so the best possible care for this body and it still gets cancer and starts dying. Even if you eat brown rice and do yoga, you still get cancer and die. One is one of the stories which really shocked me. When I was a student, even then I was like into all these alternative things like yoga. I did some yoga, and there was this program on the TV. What's it called again? I think Yoga for Life or something. And I always remember that because, you know, I was a boy at the time. There was this beautiful girl who did all these amazing postures. I really wasn't looking at the postures. I was looking at her. I do admit that. And there's also this guy, incredibly fit, and getting all these amazing postures. And just about a year or two after I became a monk, and this new monk came over, and we just started talking about yoga, and I said, oh, I remember that program, that's sort of Yoga for Health. Those guys were just so fit, and just they can get some amazing postures. And he said, you know what happened to that guy? About 1 year after sort of I left to go to Thailand, he walked on the set and dropped dead. He had some sort of heart attack or something. I couldn't believe that. This expert yoga practitioner was so fit and looked so healthy that even with yoga, you die young. So that's really unfair. So no matter what you do with your body, how much you exercise it and give it the right food, it still lets you down. So now when you're meditating, think, okay body, I've done the best. Now, nick out of here. I'm just going to watch my breath, just let go of the body. So see if you can actually throw it out. And when you throw it a long way so you can't see where it's gone. This is metaphorically that means. So you're just separated from it. And you're free from your body. And that happens, it's called kaya pasadi in the Pali. The tranquility of the body. And many of you have experienced that when you're sitting here, you're watching the breath, you can't feel the legs, you can't feel the back. You don't know where your hands are. You don't know whether it's cold or hot. Because you're not paying attention to that anymore. And that is a great sense of happiness and freedom. It's only then can you sit meditation for long periods of time. Because you can't feel the body. And if you do ever see any meditator here, or any monk or nun, sitting for long periods of time, you look at them absolutely still. And you can even take a movie of them and put it fast forward. If they were moving, and when you do it fast forward, you can see them shaking. But if you do a meditator, you know, in deep meditation, you do a movie, if you do it double fast, triple fast, 10 times fast, it'll look the same. Still absolutely still. Well, how can you hold the body so still? And the answer is you can't hold the body still. You let it go, and it's still all by itself. When you disengage, leave the body alone, throw it out, then you have this incredible stillness of the body. And already one person in an interview told me, and this is my experience and common experience as well, if you do get into that state of, you know, the body starts to disappear, and you can't feel it, you can sit for such a long period of time. When you get up afterwards, there's no aches and pains. The body feels so loose. It's counterintuitive. You sat absolutely still for such a long time. Surely you must have some aches and pains for sitting so still for so long. It's not that way. But no, if you hold a body still for even a quarter of that time, you'd always have the aches and pains. And you get up and, oh, this aches, and that's painful. It's an incredible thing that when you let go of the body, the body balances itself. And things go through nice and easily, and you're free. And when you come out afterwards, you still feel free. The body is just at ease. So this is what I mean by letting go. And the last thing you have to let go, so there you've thrown out the basket. And then you go really high, but you're still not to Nibbana yet. What haven't I let go of yet? When you let go of the body, let go of the basket, that's called, you get into the jhanas, or at least nimitta states. And in the jhanas, what now can I let go of? Actually, not just before the jhanas. What now can I let go of? You're holding on to the ropes. There's nothing else to let go of, you think. You say, ah yes, I've got it. I've not got to let go of me. So you have to let go of the ropes. So you hurtle down to the ground and obliterate. And the balloon of no self goes right up to Nibbana. And that's the highest you can go when you let go of you. And that's the last thing to throw away, yourself, the doer, and eventually the knower, until there's nothing left. That's how much you should throw things away, till there's absolutely nothing left. And when I mean nothing, I do really mean nothing. Then you go up to Nibbana. So that's actually the last bit of throwing stuff away, throwing yourself away. And there's no one there anyway, it's just this illusion of accumulated memories and ideas. Throw it all away, until there's nothing left at all. That's a simile of the balloon. The next way of letting go, just this second way is, anything you see there, throw it out. Anything at all, throw it out. And if you get stuck anywhere, look around your meditation. What am I holding on to? There must be attachment there, a weight, a burden. Find out what it is, throw it out. If you've got the right one, you go more peaceful. The next way is called freedom. What freedom means, it's this old story of one of the monks who went to go to teach in Casuarina prison when it first opened. And he was teaching and teaching and teaching, until one day they asked him, can you please stay behind? We want to talk with you. You're a friend, we want to find out how you live. And so he stayed behind. And they asked him, what's it like at your monastery? And he told them just how strictly we were, especially in those days. We get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, he said. And the prisoners were aghast. They were shocked. They were awestruck. Even in prison you don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And we've got murderers in here. What did you monks do to have to get up that early in the morning? And then what do? Can you have something to eat? No, we can't have anything at all to eat until at least sort of 6:30. When there's a breakfast, and some monks don't have any breakfast. And he was telling all about the austerities in our monastery. No sex, no music, just all those things which you like to do in the world, we just can't do. And even in prison, you can watch, they got TV in their rooms. You've got TV in your room in the monastery? No, no TVs in your bedroom, none in your kuti. I've got no TV in my cave. Those of you who haven't seen my cave, there's no TV in there. And they said, can you play sport? No, we don't play sport. There's no sort of soccer or tennis or anything in monasteries. Just meditation, mostly. And when they actually heard how austere and ascetic our monastery is, compared to a prison, they get 3 meals a day. And 3 full meals a day in prison. And even the meals they get, when they heard that sort of in a monastery you eat everything out of the bowl, they were just so shocked. Because even in prison, you get these trays, you've got compartments. They ask, do you have compartments in your bowls? So it's a treat here because they give us our sweets sort of in separate bowls. But in the monastery, we usually put them all in the same bowl. So, they were so shocked. And in fact, they were disappointed because they liked this monk. And they were just so shocked he was living such a harsh, ascetic, austere life. Now, this was actually true. One of the prisoners, they felt so sorry for their friend, the monk. Without realizing what they were saying, they said, that's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? they invited him to come and stay in jail. And they had a point, because, you know, it is more comfortable, in physically anyway, in a in a jail than it is in Bodhinyana Monastery. That's why I've got to be very careful that Amnesty International don't come to visit, because I might get in trouble. And so will the President and Vice President of the Buddhist Society as well for allowing that to happen. But when they said that, and when the monk came back and told us and made us all laugh, I reflected on that, and you got a very important piece of Dhamma from that story. Like many amusing stories, they're always very pregnant with some deep meaning. That's why they're funny. And the meaning was that why is it that people like to go and stay in monasteries? Like for our rains retreat, that women have booked up for our rains retreat until 2011. We still got one space left for 2011 for the rains retreat. But 2008, 9, 10, all full up. But people actually queue up to get to our monastery, but they queue up to try and get out of jail. What's the essential difference between a monastery and a prison? It's certainly not the comfort levels. The only difference is, in a prison, people don't want to be there. In a monastery, the monks want to be there. That's the only difference. And that's the only difference between prison and freedom. Any place you don't want to be is a prison for you. Any place you're happy to be, you'll feel free. And that's a wonderful piece of Dhamma. That explains why some people are in marriages and they feel like they're in a prison. Because they don't want to be there. That's why sometimes people are in a job. And they hate going to work on a Monday morning. It feels like a prison for them. Some people are in a body which is aching or which is dying of cancer. It can feel like a prison for you. So how do you escape from those prisons? Do you have to change your partner? No. Just want to be there instead. Appreciate that relationship, appreciate that person. Until, wow, it's actually quite nice being with this guy or this girl. When you want to be there, it's not a prison anymore. You're free. You don't have to change from a monastery to a prison or a prison to a monastery to be free. It's that attitude change of wanting to be there. Or in your job. Wanting to be with your job. Yeah, sure, it's hard and you have to work very hard, but why do you think they pay you? Your salary is only a bribe to make you do what you'd rather not do. If you enjoyed your work, go and tell your boss and they'll halve your salary to save money for the shareholders. It's obviously, that's why they pay you, because you don't like it. But if you want to be there, then you're free. And it's the same in your body. It might be getting very sick and sometimes you don't want to be there. Sometimes you think, I want my body when it was healthy once, when it was young and I could do things. But if you want to be somewhere else and someone else, you make a prison out of your body. And if you want to be free, you don't have to jump the walls. Just changing attitudes. I'm happy to be here. When you want to be here, you are free. And that's how you let go in meditation. Maybe you've got sloth and torpor. Do you want to be there? Do you want to be somewhere else? If you're sleeping and you want to be somewhere else, you now stop yourself being free. You made a prison for yourself. That's why it's called suffering. If you've got sloth and torpor and you're at ease with it, you're at peace with it, it's just old karma, then suddenly you feel so free. Got sloth and torpor, so what? This is good enough for me. I'm free, at least I'm not breaking any precepts when I got sloth and torpor. Or if you're restless, want to be there, say, okay, restlessness is good enough for me, I'm happy to be here, then you're free. You've got the breath, you've got the beautiful breath, or just any old breath, and you want the next stage. I've got the breath, please, I want the full awareness of the breath. You've got the full awareness of the breath, come on, beautiful breath, it's coming next. You never want to be here. You always want to be somewhere else. That's why the meditation feels like a prison. And the mind is a terrible place to be. So if you understand what freedom is, it's wanting to be here wherever that is. Even like having a cough, Suwadi. Be happy, I've got a cough. And then the cough, and just cough, go for it. And that means you'll feel so free. If you don't want to have that cough, you feel like you get scrunched up, you're in a prison, like in a cell being punished for something, you don't know why. In every stage of the meditation, want to be there. Even when you get the beautiful nimittas. I don't know how many people, they get this wonderful deep state of meditation and they blow it. You know why? They got the nimitta, they're so close to jhana, so the next stage, I want the jhana. They don't feel free with the nimitta. That's what happens, you know, when people get so close to the goal. In any sport, the team which suffers the most is the team which gets to the final and loses. If you lose early on in the competition, you don't suffer so much. You get so close and... Or when people have the lottery and they get all those numbers. First number, second number, third number, fourth number, fifth number, sixth number. Didn't get it. When you get so close and you fail. And that's what happens even with nimittas. You're about to get the jackpot. You're so close that you want just that last little piece. And that's why you don't feel free and the meditation becomes a prison and it all fades away. So a great way of letting go is just wanting to be here, wherever you happen to be right now. This is good enough for me. I'm just happy to be here. When you're happy to be here, there's no way that desire and craving can arise. You're content. This is good enough for me. Like in a monastery, it's not the most comfortable place. You can make it more comfortable. I know many of the monks have said we should have room service. So they can have a menu for breakfast in the morning. That's only a joke, they don't say that. But, you know, you can always make it more comfortable. But that's missing the point. I miss the point that this is good enough. When it's good enough, you're happy to be here, whatever that happens to be. Or you feel this incredible sense of freedom. And that freedom leads to a deepening of the meditation very quickly. When you're happy to be with the breath becomes a beautiful breath. It's obvious. When you're just happy to be with a beautiful breath, oh, I've got a beautiful breath, this is amazing, this is wonderful. You get so much energy, the breath, nimittas start coming up. You say, wow, nimitta, now this is enough. Thank you so much for having a nimitta. It's good enough for me. The little me has got a nimitta. My first meditation retreat, I got a nimitta. I said, oh, amazing. I'm so happy. This will do me for the whole rest of the retreat. And if that's your attitude, you get into a jhana straight away. Because you've got no desire. You don't want anything more. You feel free. And that freedom, that stillness, stops the craving, which makes the leaf move. Nothing is moving the leaf, so it goes more and more still until it stops. So try that during the meditation. Just want to be here, wherever that is. Contentment. It's really good enough. You're not being tortured. You know, you're not in Guantanamo Bay. You're just sitting here. This is fine. It's even better. You're not at work. You're not in the office. You don't have to sort of get all these people on your back and answering emails and telephone calls all the time. Well, it's a pretty nice place to be. Especially on a Monday morning. So just be so happy and grateful to be here. Wherever that is in your mind, even if you're anxious, you're restless, you're tired, it's not that bad. I'm just happy to be tired. Just my body needed a rest, and it's just all karma coming out. Okay, come. Leave it alone. Allow it to be. Be happy to be here. And then you are free. That's the third way of letting go. And the last way of letting go is anālaya. And the word alaya, ad means the opposite, means no alias, alaya. And the alaya many people know because there is a famous mountain range called Himalaya, the Himalayas. That is not, shouldn't be really pronounced Himalaya, Himalaya. And Alia means the resting place, the abode. And Hima means snow. That's the abode of snow, the resting place of snow. Or you've got another Indian state, Meghalaya, which is the abode of the clouds. That's because it's always cloudy up there. And Alia is always a place where things rest and settle. Analia means having no place where anything settles. In other words, the thought comes in and it goes out again. Experiences come and they just fall off you like the water from the lotus leaf. You don't keep things. What I've called the Teflon mind. Even beautiful experiences, they don't stick. This is my mother's mantle shelf again. Whenever you put something on, it's there for a second and disappears. So it's always empty. It's natural state. You don't accumulate and keep things, because this is all about letting go. So you have a mind like Teflon, this non-stick surface which people put on their frying pans and other stuff, which means you can fry your eggs, you can boil things up, or whatever it is, and you don't need to wash it so much because it doesn't stick. Try and have a mind like Teflon, so nothing sticks. Whatever happened yesterday, earlier today, whatever happened now, nothing sticks. Not even what I've just said. It all goes in one ear and out the other, which is what it usually does anyway. And it's a good thing that, because the whole idea of Teflon sort of is what remains. So the past is completely let go of as soon as it happens. And that way, again, you're free, you've let go. With that letting go, there's an incredible sense of peace and stillness. The leaf has got nothing to move it. So it will keep on moving. You'll see it move, but less and less and less, as you stop the wind of craving. And as you get more and more still, not only do you experience that stillness, the happiness and bliss of it, but also you understand it. The calm and the insight come together. You have the insight into what stillness and peace really is. What is this elusive peace of mind which people crave for or want or aspire towards? You understand what peace of mind is because you've got it right in front of you. Those are the insights which are really important. You get the insight in how this peace of mind comes about. You know what letting go is. You know why the Buddha included those four things under the third noble truth, the very first discourse he gave. Not just to say that letting go is the end of suffering, but to say what that letting go actually is and how it's achieved. So that when you do meditate, you can just give 100%, not expecting anything back. You get the attitude not of accumulating things, but of throwing things out. See how empty your shelf can be. You're just happy to be here, wherever that is. So you always feel free. And nothing sticks. So the past is just gone. So you're fully free and liberated. Not only does that take you into jhanas, it takes you all the way to the end of suffering, to nirvana itself. So it's easy. So there you go. There is how to get enlightened. And if you get enlightened today, then you don't have to, you can actually leave this evening, you don't have to come back tomorrow to sit and get up early in the morning again. You can have a sleep in. But if you really get enlightened, let us know, we can have get another cake for you, have a party. Anyone who gets enlightened can deserve an enlightenment party during this retreat. But now you all know how it's done, so off you go and do it. So that's how to let go. Is there any questions before we start the interviews? Yeah?
That thing on freedom that you're talking about,
yeah.
Is that really about taking a decision and taking responsibility for the decision to be where you are? In other words, if you're sitting meditating, you take responsibility for being sitting there and not part of you fantasizing or thinking is there an essence of that third one, taking a decision to be where you are?
It's the essence of that third one, not so much taking a decision to be where they are, but the whole attitude of meditation sort of changes from appreciating the small things of meditation and not sort of being this, as I said yesterday, the fault-finding mind. This is not good enough. Well, it is good, but it could be better. Now, I'm having a great retreat, but you know, there's still more to do. Come on, get your act together. Let's go deeper. That sort of attainment, ambition, which will actually you find will never find any rest anywhere. Don't know how much ambition you want, that it never is fulfilled because there's always something more to do. There's always another peak to climb. So because of that, eventually you have to say this is good enough. Otherwise, you'll never rest at all, anywhere, throughout your whole series of lives. So it's a different attitude of not looking for the next thing, but appreciating the thing you have now. Yes?
Finally, you say, give the instructions at the beginning and then just let the mind in. But then you also say, put effort into being into the moment.
Mm.
I'm not quite sure whether, like, I could just sit there and sort of drift away after giving the instructions, whether I should actually try to actually be in that moment.
When you really look at it deeply, to put effort to be in the moment, you're already here. What actually is that effort? Usually what the effort is, I'm going to be in the moment in the next moment. Okay, the next moment I'm going to do it. Because this moment is already here. You already are here. But sometimes we can't see this here, always the next thing. We think, oh, this moment is not good enough. I'm going to sort of start meditation from the next moment. Because all effort is what you're going to do next. That's why it sort of misses the point. What we're trying, we're always trying to get somewhere else. We don't need to try to be here because we already are here. It's just we don't appreciate being here. So the real effort in meditation is it's an effort to stop the effort, if you know what I mean. It's that mindfulness to say, come on, rest, relax. Stop doing this effort thing, and this craving thing, and this will thing. Stop blowing on the leaf. That's why, you know, all trying. I've seen that myself, you know, sitting there and getting a bit sleepy. Come on, get in meditation. And what I mean is, from the next moment on, I'm going to really meditate. I mean, you're missing the point, because it's the moment now is the only moment you have. And you're already here. All you need to do is to stay here, stay put. And stop thinking about, you know, meditation begins in the next moment. Because that's what the effort is, that's all the trying to do something next. Which is why that sometimes a thought comes into mind. Very often people get nimittas and they think, what should I do next? If that thought ever comes up, what should I do next? Alarm bell should ring. Dummy! It's nothing to do with next, it's what you're doing now. So anytime, what should I do next? That's an alarm bell, stupid question. You're being a dummy again. What should I do next doesn't exist in meditation. It's what you're doing now. The only way we can create a beautiful future is to care for this moment. That's all you do in meditation. Care for this moment. And the future will evolve according to itself, not according to your efforts and desires and cravings. So just be here. You already are here. Just realize it more. Go deeper and be happy to be here. And then freedom comes. Stillness comes. And the very, very deep meditations will just come. But when you're trying to get somewhere else, trying to do something else, you're already off in the future and you miss it. That's so important in the deeper stages of meditation. That's where all effort has to stop completely. That's why I say sometimes I use visualizations. I give, like, the keys, thinking I'm driving a car, give the keys to the nimitta. Okay, you drive now. I'm going to be a complete passenger. So you don't do anything. Still. Give up. Does that make sense? You sort of know.
Not really.
Yeah. Okay. It's an effort of mindfulness, so you're aware what's happening, whether you're in the moment or you're not in the moment. And with that awareness, it's sort of like a guard to stop yourself moving. So it's an effort to stop things, not an effort to move things along. You know, that's why it's like the bouncers on a nightclub, to stop these idiots getting in and wrecking your peace and your fun. So mindfulness is also like the bouncer at the nightclub door. And will is one of those, you know, those gangs, like the coffin cheaters or the Hell's Angels, which come in and create all sorts of mayhem in the sort of the club. So, you know, you want to look out for those and keep them out.
So you could say it's a gentle effort.
It's a preventative effort, not an active effort. It's an effort which says no, which says stop. It's not an effort which initiates more things. Okay, we'll have a, let that settle in there and see what that, what comes out later on. Yeah, Bill, you have a question?
I was just thinking, is it the effort is kind of being there, is it just being sitting down? I mean, is there a kind of right effort versus against? Is there a right effort in doing it? It's like that similar you have about the mango.
Yeah.
You actually put your arm out to see what you can
do. Yeah. That's about all there is, so it's hardly any effort at all. And it's a lot of the effort to receive rather than the effort to do things. The passive mind rather than the active mind. But try that out, because the less effort you put into the meditation, first of all, the more sleepy you get. But then you go through that sleepiness. You get this incredible peace and stability. You're just happy to be here, wherever that is. Non-judgmental. The door of my heart is open to this moment, no matter what it is. Completely free to be here. And that gives you enormous depth. And because there's a stillness there, the way the mind works, its law of nature is the less you do, the more the energy starts to build up. Because the energy of the mind has to go somewhere. It usually just gets wasted in doing things and controlling and thinking and manipulating and changing, and it wastes so much energy that way. When you're happy to be here, when you're just letting go, you're not demanding anything, you're not expecting anything, you're just here, all the energy doesn't get wasted. And it builds and builds and builds and builds. We make peace in every moment. The energy builds so strong, that's when the mindfulness really gets brilliant. And that's when you start to see the beautiful flowers outside. The bricks and everything else. Because the mindfulness has increased enormously. You get so blissed out and happy. And meditation is so easy. Because you're not doing anything. And it works. Yes. Okay, last question, because I've had some interviews.
Sometimes in my meditation, I can catch the beginning of a thought and stop that continuing. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, sometimes you say, sometimes in meditation you catch the beginning of the thought and then you can sort of stop it happening. Yeah, there's the effort to avoid, effort to stop things. And after a while, just because you keep stopping the thought before it has a chance to establish itself, it just gives up after a while. As if thought thinks, oh, she knows my game. And she's not letting me sort of, you know, even get a foot in the door. And after a while, just thought gives up and leaves you alone. Then you're still and peaceful. So, there you've got four ways of letting go to play around with today. Give everything to this moment. Not expecting anything back. And what's the next one is just see how many things you can throw off your shelf, call the mind, so you've got nothing left on the mind at all. And be happy to be here. It's just so nice to be in this moment. In this old body which is dying of cancer. Oh, this is good enough for me. It could be worse. And just, no, that's one in her. And, you know, you've got a much better body than hers. Wow, you should be so relieved with your body. And just happy to be in this moment. And what's the last one? His last one is, nothing sticks. So if anything I said you don't agree with, let it drop completely. Anything I said which really inspired you, throw that out as well. So you've got nothing left. So you're free. Okay, so off you go. Oh, we've got the interviews now.